Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, the show in which a comedian comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Comedy isn't therapy, but it does have a similar ability of reframing challenging experiences and feelings in a way that just feels lighter and more manageable. It also gives people a vocabulary to understand the hard to understand. So considering, you know, everything, I wanted to rerun this episode from the great stand-up comedian Aparna Nancharla about her joke about anxiety. The funny thing, as sometimes happens on this show, I remember when she started doing this joke. Aparna moved to New York from LA in late 2012 to work on Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. Around then, I'd see her perform her deeply silly act around Brooklyn. And then I distinctly remember when her material shifted. The silliness was still there in parts, but now Aparna was talking about her struggles with depression and anxiety. This episode is about that breakthrough, how her career in comedy is so connected to her history with mental illness, how her comedy isn't as much about anxiety and depression as people think, and, you know, writing good jokes. The joke you're about to hear is from her debut album, Just Putting It Out There, which came out in 2016, the same year she did her Comedy Central half-hour special. In 2018, she did a half-hour special for Netflix's The Stand-Ups. Since this episode came out in August 2018, I just wanted to mention that right now you can currently see Aparna every Monday co-hosting a digital version of my favorite weekly New York stand-up show, Butterboy, with Joe Firestone and Maeve Higgins. So, here is Aparna Nancharla.
I have a lot of anxiety. It's a pretty solid part of my life. Like, and how many, any stress heads in the house tonight? Yeah! That was a good amount. So usually people are just like, we're scared. But I actually find it weirder to not have anxiety than to have it. Because I feel like if you're not scared, you're not paying attention, you know? If you opened a newspaper today and you skim the headlines, you're just like, seems cool. It's like, what? Everything's on fire. Are you kidding me? And sometimes people are like, oh, well, you know, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. Have you checked out some of Fear's work? Pretty much churning out the hits since forever, making a lot of great points. If you don't have anxiety, to me, what it feels like is there's like an edgy improv group in your brain that just needs like a one-word suggestion to spin like countless scenarios that no one's comfortable with. It's like, when will this show be over? I just came to be supportive. But I've had anxiety forever, and I have all kinds of it. Like, I have social anxiety, which is ironically one of the most relatable kinds. Like, sometimes... Yeah, it's weird. Like, sometimes mine will get so bad, I can't even talk to babies without getting self-conscious. Like, the whole time I'm just like, what if I'm not an interesting thing, shape, or color. Oh, make a fist. Try to relate. But yeah, I've had anxiety my whole life, and it's gotten to a point where I feel more comfortable with it than without it. And luckily, I live in one of the anxiety hotspots of the planet, New York City. It's like top 10 places to have a panic attack, you know? It's like up there. I saw an ambulance cut off another ambulance the other day. I was like, perfect! Settings are accurate!
I am here with the person behind that joke, Aparna Nancharla. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into this specific joke, I thought a good place to start would be just sort of give a sort of baseline history of your personal history with mental illness, and sort of how did it relate to your pursuit of comedy?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was diagnosed with depression in college, and I had taken some time off from school because of issues I was having around eating, and I think I just needed a break. I was kind of stuck in a lot of ways, and that's when I officially was, and then I went on antidepressants, and it's kind of weird in hindsight because I think that initial boost from going on medication was what gave me the courage to try stand-up because I think it was far, far outside my comfort zone as an introvert. But then when I started, I didn't at all talk about it because I almost, because of the meds and stuff, it wasn't like as present an issue mm-hmm. for me in terms of struggling with it. So I think I didn't actually start talking about having like depression. And I think the flip side of it was anxiety for me for a long time, but I just didn't have the name for it.
Yeah.
And weirdly, I think maybe the anxiety has gotten more exacerbated by being in a career with a lot of stressors. But so then I think maybe a couple years in, I had kind of a depressive rut and started writing about depression just because it was the big thing consuming my brain and I was having trouble writing about anything else. And then I think I tried it on stage just because that's all I had written as of recent, and it resonated with people in a way that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
So I think it encouraged me to explore it more. But I think what kept me back was that I was like, well, a lot of people, you know, are already great with talking about mental health, like Maria Bamford or Mark Maron or Patton Oswalt. So I think I didn't know if I had anything necessarily to add to the dialogue.
So specifically, had you toured with Maria at that point? I know at some point you had opened for her.
Yeah, I think I opened for her early on when I started in DC, and I think I even remember one night before going on stage being like, I have some jokes about being like a quiet person. Is it okay if I do? I don't want to step on anything you're doing. And she was like, do whatever you want. Like, don't worry about it at all. But of course, I was like very in my head about it.
Did you see her doing the work she does about that? And I wouldn't say like jealous, but you were like, oh, what were you feeling about watching her do that stuff as a person who knows who's dealing with it, who wasn't necessarily talking about it on stage?
Yeah, I think I was just really inspired by it, but also in that way of like, oh, like she's so on another level. Like I can't really touch what she's doing, so why bother? Which is a very much like a perfectionist thought. But I was like, she's so like good and nuanced at the way she covers it that I don't know that I have anything close to that level of insight.
You mentioned though you're dealing with certain things, you weren't necessarily talking about it. And so I wanted, it might be useful to sort of describe what you were doing. And I believe the first time I ever saw you, which was you just moved to New York, and I think it's at Big Terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just loving your act and loving how still you are. And I have this vague memory of a bit where you pretended to be a Muppet.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a real
joke? Oh, my
gosh.
That was like a long time ago. And I didn't even remember that I did it in New York, because I remember I had moved from L.A. and I was like, I had done it there. And it was so weird and like different from anything else I was doing that sometimes I was like, I really don't know what to do with this. Like, I don't know if I can actually ever record it or put it anywhere. So I think it eventually just got shuffled out. But yeah, that's so funny. That
what was it? Because I really have. Did you turn your shirt around? I really have like.
Yeah. It was just I had this hat and then I bought this hair clip that was just like these two big googly eyes on either end. So then when you put it on the hat, it kind of looked like a weird face. And then I just like turned around so that like my hair was it was almost like cousin it, I guess. Where the hair was the rest of the face. But I just sort of like turned around and it looked like a Muppet. And it was like a very absurd character called Muppet Comic.
What did you think of your act at that time? You know, before you're doing this stuff, you know, 2012, 2013.
Well, even early on, I think I had trouble, like I would write jokes and they would kind of be distinct things, but I always had trouble like connecting everything together and having like bigger chunks thematically. So I think, because I hadn't done an album yet and any sets I had recorded, I don't even think I had done a late night set yet. So I really wasn't thinking in terms of structure very much. So everything felt like these distinct different parts. And I wasn't even sure like what the overall takeaway was for the audience or anything. Like I was like, I don't even know what kind of person I'm really coming across as. So I think when I started talking about mental health, that at least helped me be like, okay, these are like different aspects of your life or personality that you can kind of bring up in more like ways that connect together.
You mentioned that you started writing about it sort of out of, you could literally, your brain could not think, you were just like, I'm writing about this because I'm in this state.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything of what that material was like the first time you started doing it?
I mean, I think even in my joke book, it just looks very much like a journal where it's just like the same circular thought over and over again. I'm just like, what's the point? Like, why are we all here? And I was like, this is not even funny. And I think maybe I pulled out like one line that I maybe tweeted or something later where it was like, sometimes I feel sad for no reason, but then I'll remember the reasons.
Yeah.
And that kind of did well as a tweet. So I was like, oh, maybe that's something I could like flesh out on stage. So I think that was actually the initial little nugget that turned into a bigger thing.
I think that way of phrasing it is in this anxiety joke as well, which is like, oh, I don't know why I'd be anxious other than like the reasons. Obviously, that one.
Yeah.
This version, do you remember how this started, the anxiety?
Yeah,
chunk?
I think, how did the anxiety chunk start? I think it was, and it's weird now because it is, I have that line about opening a newspaper and it's like the news has gotten so cartoonish that like the fact that this was in like 2015 or whenever I recorded it, 2016, now it seems even more insane to be like, yeah, like no one can read the news now and not be anxious. Like you don't even have to have anxiety to really relate to it. But maybe it was the first time I really started struggling with like performing on stage and like my anxiety was so bad that I was like, maybe I'll just like talk about being anxious. And maybe even if it won't be in the exact context of like being that uncomfortable on stage, like at least as a broader theme, maybe people will relate to it.
I mean, it felt like the core is, I actually find it weirder not to have anxiety than to have it, which I think it's a thing that at least I know from even talking to my own therapist, which is sort of like lots of people have thoughts and these things are possible, right?
Yeah.
Like you can be hit by a bus. That's definitely possible. The thing is most people are able to not keep on thinking about it.
Yeah. And it's also like, to me, it feels like that thing where like, if you live in New York City, it is like being hit by a bus or something could just be like one little thing that happened in your day. Like it's not even that far outside the realm of possibility. But then I guess it feels like there are two types of people, like the people who just keep like thinking about the fact that they could have easily just been hit by a bus that morning. And then the people are like, on to the next thing. And I'm like, I just don't understand how you can move on from that.
I do like the idea that you're like, New York City, anything is possible. You're like, you could hit by a bus.
Yeah. Like all the horrible things that could happen.
You wouldn't even bring it up. Yeah.
Dreams. Yeah.
I feel like I've heard that I would say you have a hybrid process of writing both off stage and on stage. Can you talk a little bit about what that is, what that's like, and sort of maybe in the context of a joke like this?
Yeah, I mean, even now that I feel like I maybe have less time to write these days, or just less time to sit and think about jokes, like, I think it does help me, especially when trying out new material, to kind of have at least the beats fleshed out, or like what I want to say, or the overall structure of what the joke might be. And then maybe on stage I can find like a new line or a new angle or a direction to go in. But I do feel like I need that framework to think it out verbally. Yeah.
When you say a beat, how much of the joke is, you know, like, are you like, okay, I will say, will you be like, oh, maybe I'll bring up newspapers and then like people that, you know, like, or are you just sort of like, okay, I have the beat, which is, you're more comfortable having anxiety.
Yeah. And for that part, I think it was actually that if you're not scared, you're not paying attention was the first thing I thought of, like that line. And then I sort of fleshed out around it. Like, well, what does that mean? Like, does that mean like when you read the news, or like, what, like, why is that true to you? Like, I think I was like, this is so true to me. I guess it's weird to me if you couldn't relate to this. So then I think the rest of it kind of built around it. But that was like, I was like, this line feels like it could be one of the beats. Yeah.
Well, it's a very like, it's interesting because it's like, it's kind of, it's like wordplay, but not like how we traditionally think of wordplay. It's not like a pun as much as like it's a play on a certain sort of saying.
Yeah, or the, yeah, like if you're not mad, you're not paying attention.
Yeah, I literally try to find it. The earliest example I saw was if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention.
Oh, right, okay.
But
it is about like injustice. And,
Yeah.
And I think for me, I was like, I've always, with that expression, I think I've always like had problems expressing anger and like being in touch with my anger. So I'm like, how would that expression, like, how would it translate in my world? And I was like, I think it's fear. It's generally always fear.
It's sort of structured like an argument with somebody where you're like, you might say this, but in reality, like, have you checked out fear's work?
Yeah.
In your head, who's the person that you're arguing with?
I don't know if I have a specific person, but I guess it is like someone who doesn't have anxiety. But I feel like now I'm so... like so many of my friends are comedians now that I'm like, I don't even know if I know someone like that. But yeah, I guess in my head it was like, well, let's say not everyone in the audience knows what anxiety is. How would you explain to them what it's like in your brain, or why you have trouble not seeing the world that way?
You know, there's a version of this joke that is then 4 more minutes of a joke, or like a minute more of a joke, where you're like completely like, and now I'm going to be doing that.
like a little bit of an act out of would that? Yes. I think, I'm not sure why I shortened it, because I think that happens a lot where I'll just try it a bunch of different ways and then I'll just end up one of the ways, but it won't even necessarily be like, oh, that wasn't working. Because I think sometimes it was, but I just like was like, I don't need this part.
It's probably also, there's more, right? There's like,
yes.
It's like, there's a rhythm of this thing that if you then like, okay, I'm now going to do a full improv scene and then I come back to make more points.
Yeah. And I feel like there are some comedians where you're like, and then they would do the full improv show. And I think I wish I were one of those comedians sometimes, because I was like, that would be really fun to see. But then I'm like, I can't think. I'll just put in another tweet like thought.
But yeah, it is why this is a sort of a joke that came later in your act, which was the dropping the pills joke.
There is no way to pick up pills that you've spilled on the ground without looking like a total human red flag. You know, there's just no way to be like, oh! This is what I meant to do, and everything is going great.
I remember seeing you do that. I'm like, oh, she figured out how to do an Aparna-style act out.
140-character act out.
Speaking of 140 characters, I have social anxiety, which is ironically one of the most relatable kinds.
Yeah, which is, that line is really funny because, I mean, it's funny in the, not the, oh, it's hilarious to me, but it's like odd in the sense that I think I said that line just to set up that transition to like talking about a specific kind of anxiety. And that always gets a big laugh. And I don't even think I meant it to be funny when I first said it. And then I was like, I guess this is a joke, because people really seem to think it's funny, but I even now I'm just like, I still don't see why that's that funny.
Was the baby thing come out of a real experience? The being nervous that babies don't like you?
Yeah, I think that that happens a lot where it's like when babies or dogs don't like me, I'm like, oh, they can see my true bad self. So I think I was like, how do I write a joke about that? And then I was like, well, it's kind of funny if like small talk, like you're so nervous about small talk, you can't even talk to like someone who doesn't have language without getting scared. I had that joke actually early on, like way early in stand-up, maybe like 2 or 3 years in. And then I didn't really know what to do with it. And then when I started talking about anxiety, I was like, oh, this would actually make sense to work back in. So I think just having that setup of like, oh, I'm an anxious person, it helped transition to kind of this more absurdist bit.
So to use the sort of the big end, which is I saw an ambulance cut off another ambulance the other day. Is that one a thing you saw? And is that a thing you'd probably write? Where you're like, what is an example of the most New York version of anxiety?
I think I actually did see that. And then I was like, oh, that's kind of a perfect encapsulation of like how much chaos there is here.
Yeah.
Where it's like even someone trying to help someone is like being an asshole.
So you have an amount that you sort of hear the beats and you talk it out. I mean, this I imagine is a joke you had for a while. How is your process sort of tinkering? Are you sort of listening back? Are you like constantly playing with stuff?
I do listen back, but ironically, it's like less to tinker. I mean, it is. I find listening back very helpful if I said something that I don't remember that was new, or like if I'm trying a new bit to get the wording right. But in general, I think I mainly record sets because I found like when I have bad stage fright, like listening to an old set I did will remind me that like, oh, you've done this before. And it weirdly like helps me feel more calm. But
yeah,
so it's almost just like to be like, it's almost like a memento style thing of like, no, remember, you are a comedian.
Because I think I've heard you talk about you really like getting to the point where you're like, this joke is now a thing.
Yeah.
And then keeping on doing it is the harder part. What motivates you to keep on sort of building on a thing?
I think I have trouble really with a joke ever being done. And I know there are people who like can tinker with the joke forever. And it's not like I'm like, you know, moving commas around, like I'm not that meticulous, but I am like, I'll like, especially when I'm touring, I feel like the joke will like at the end of like a year, it'll sound like different than it did at the beginning of the year. Just, I guess, because you have to keep it interesting for yourself too. And you feel like the more you tell it, like you find new things about it, or you're like, oh, this part actually doesn't feel like it applies to me anymore, or like, I need to explain this better. But like, even after I record stuff, like if I keep doing it, it'll just keep changing.
Case in point, you did this joke also on your half hour, which was, I think, probably recorded about a year later.
Later, yeah.
So now I'm going to tell you what changed.
Ooh.
I just have them written down. Instead of saying any stress heads in the audience, you say I have a lot of anxiety, which don't be mistaken by this sexy drag queen stage persona.
Oh, interesting. I don't even remember if I added that. I don't even remember adding that line there. And now I feel like I use that line in a different joke I've been doing about being an introvert.
Yeah.
So that's so interesting. I have no memory of this.
So the newspaper joke, you added another tag, which was, even the newspaper's on fire.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Was that just sort of, you're like, they're laughing, so we just keep on riffing, and then...
I think so. I think it was funny to me to be like reading a newspaper and like the news is really alarming. And then you're like, even... like, it's so alarming, like, even the paper's on fire. Like, everything is so chaotic that, like, even people reading newspapers, they're on fire.
And the other big change was after the improv thing, you say, when will the show be over? I just came to be supportive. And then you add, none of these thoughts have a future.
Oh, yeah. I think that was almost like a little button line.
That also makes sense of, like, you were there watching it. It is, as we were talking about, that you... don't act it out, that you placed yourself in the audience of your own thoughts.
Yes, 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 yes. And also, like, it's kind of a dig at improvisers, which I didn't mean it to be, but I was like, if we're really going to see this analogy through, you got to cap it.
The improv part of the joke made me think about how you came up in a time as a comedian who can essentially avoid, like, club, comedy club. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain sort of criticism that came up with that that generation of comedians came up, and then there's a generation of older comedians who are mad at them.
Yes.
Who are like, you can't be a comedian if your scene's too supportive or whatever.
Right.
And I think that's, there's lots of very good comedians. And I'm like, I think that supportiveness allows for a lot of things. But, you know, what is your response to that criticism?
Yeah, it's interesting because I might have my own chip on my shoulder or like preconceptions about clubs, but I do feel in general like I've found it easier to grow and try things outside of the clubs. And when I've done the clubs, I felt like I've had to stick to more like kind of like straightforward, cut and dry jokes. And even like doing headlining sets and like touring, like sometimes I would feel like when I did the mental health stuff, people would like kind of like shut down a little bit. Not everywhere, like there would always be exceptions to that, but for in general it seemed like they didn't want something outside of what the idea of like club comedy is. So in that sense I was kind of like, well, I feel like I've tried doing these rooms, and if it's like, if I'm not enjoying them as much and if the audience isn't enjoying it as much, then like, who is this for? Yeah. You know, like if I'm just trying to impress some like internalized old comedy guy in my head, like that feels like not worth it at the end of the day.
That is a much smaller audience than the audience that is actually.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's different like when you get to a place where like it's like you're filling out clubs and everyone there knows who you are and they know what they're getting. But I think if you're still at a point where you're like building an audience, you're still going to like clubs still have a higher factor of like random people who are just there to be like, I'm at a club. I'm going to see comedy. I don't know what I'm going to see necessarily, but I have an idea of what the type of comedy I want to see. Like, I think that's when there's like more of a disconnect between the performer and the audience's expectation.
You mentioned that, especially sort of as you're touring, there'd be some people that you can feel a tightening up or something about when you were talking about this stuff. How did it, I guess, in general, how did it feel both when that happens, because it is a more personal material, when they're backing away and it's more about you in that regard? And in general, how did it feel the opposite, like when people did like it more?
Yeah, because I always assume like when audiences are quiet, it's like not funny. And sometimes that is the case. But then I also realize sometimes when you do more personal stuff, they're quiet because they just are like, are we allowed to laugh? Like, should we be laughing at this? We don't know. So I forget that too, that sometimes, because I do a lot of self-deprecating stuff. And I think sometimes people see like a small woman doing that and they're like, oh, that's sad. I'm like, no, it's not sad.
It's like, I did this on purpose.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it is that fine line of like, oh, but it's okay, you guys, I'm fine.
And then on the other side, how did it feel when people like really liked it?
I think it was very rewarding. And I think it was also or like comforting and like cool to see people relating to it, in that I was like, oh, wow, it's neat that I'm not the only one who feels this way. But also, like, I feel like I would get emails of that were just, like, so heartfelt of people being like, I've been struggling with this. And it was just so nice to hear someone talk about it. And it's like, you just, like, heard me string three tweets together. And it made you feel better. And that's, like, crazy. And I feel really grateful for that.
You mentioned being not thinking you should do it, partly because other people have done it so well. Now that you've done it, and especially at the time, did you feel like, oh, there is a space for me to do it?
I think so. I mean, sometimes people have been like, oh, like, you know, in the external sense, they've been like, oh, well, it's also just nice to see a woman of color talking about comedy. And that's like something that isn't always explored in like the minority community, like mental health or like the immigrant community. It can be like a more stigmatized topic. So I think in that sense, I'm like, oh, I guess it is like a new thing in some sense. I've heard like so many more comedians talk about mental health now, and it does feel weird to just be like, oh, that's my hook. Like, you can't use it. Like, I'm like, that if it's part of your life, it's part of your life. You got to talk about it.
What did this joke sort of mean for your stand-up? Like, was it a breakthrough? Sort of what did it then carry you to keep on doing?
It was a breakthrough in me for a way to like be more personal on stage and more vulnerable. I think I still do keep a level of distance, like, because I think everyone, like Nanette recently came out, and I feel like it has gotten a lot of people talking about the difference between, you know, being vulnerable and being sort of the butt of your own joke. So I do think I still have this level of distance between my material and like my rawest emotions. But I think it did breach the topic of like, oh, there's a lot of like dark stuff in my head and maybe it's okay to talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned Nanette, and it's funny because when I saw it, I ran into all the people like associate, like the Team Butter Boy, the show that you host on.
Oh yeah.
Because I was there, and Marianne Ways was there, and Joe Firestone was there, and Maeve was there.
Because I sent out, like, as soon as I saw it, I like sent out this email that I was like, guys, I never recommend stuff, but you all have to go see this show. And then they listened to me.
What made you, as a person who is a comedian, emailing people who see comedy all the time, what is it that you felt you wanted to?
I think I love deconstructionism in general, and I think it just deconstructs what is comedy in like a really compelling way and kind of looks at the, like if an audience member is uncomfortable at a joke or something, like where does that come from? Or like what is in the structure that makes jokes like sometimes dissatisfying in terms of addressing issues? And I feel like I've been getting the question a lot, as a lot of comedians have, since the political climate has gotten so charged about, do you think comedy can like solve social issues? And like, do you think comedians are like vital in this environment? And it's like, yes, like I think we're important in that we can speak truth to power. But I think it's gotten sometimes a little too extreme, where it's almost like comedians are the new like policymakers, and it's like, I don't think that was ever our role. But also it's like, what are the limitations of comedy in that sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One other thing I was thinking about with Nanette is one of the things that it directly attacks or sort of goes after is this idea that mental illness is directly correlated with creativity. Mm-hmm. And I think comedy has this very specific version of the narrative of like these sad clowns that are like, oh, all comedians are depressed.
Right.
Which I think is not, can't be, one is not correct. And also just sort of comedians talk about their lives more than,
right.
It'd be like, if every cop had to talk about their life, you'd be like, but sort of what is your feeling about that convention?
I do think there is a way of seeing the world that a lot of comedians share in terms of constantly questioning everything and turning everything around and being like, well, why is it this way? And it's like, what is the goal here? And I think that does run into like some depressive modes of thinking, sure, of like constantly being like, well, I don't understand like what the end game is. But yeah, so I think in that sense, it is just this mindset where you're not taking things for face value. And I mean, a weird thing, I majored in psychology in college, and I always, one of the things that always stuck with me that I learned early on was that like depressives are essentially just realists, and people who are happy are essentially slightly delusional. So you have to be slightly delusional to be happy.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, I mean, you could use that to justify that like the world really is a grim place. And I mean, there is an element of randomness to it, but I think, yeah, in that sense, comedians are just like, they don't want to like sugarcoat or like rose colored glasses things, because they want to get at like the heart of like human behavior, or like why things work the way they do.
We'll be back with more Aparna Nancharla after this word from our sponsor.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
We are back with Aparna. Then, and the time of this joke, and even now, you don't necessarily talk exclusively about mental illness. It sort of tends to be either at the beginning or just like a little part.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think it sort of frames the rest of your act and how people perceive you?
I've had that same thought where I'm like, it's not like it is the overall arching theme of my set. It'll be like something I touch on, but then I kind of talk about other things. But maybe having that filter maybe colors the rest of my material. I'm not sure, because I feel like maybe as an audience member, it's very much a different experience than me. Because to me, it does, just in that, like, during my set, I'm, like, generally anxious a lot of the time or, like, negative about it afterwards. But, yeah, I don't know if I, like, keep mentioning that if I'm doing, like, a long set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a thing that, preparing for this interview, I'm like, people really, like, every headline you've of every interview with you, it's like, depression.
That also has been weird to me sometimes, where I'm like, that's not the only thing I talk about. But I guess people like to, like, pin a thing on you and be like, this is something new, and that's what you'll get from her.
Yeah. I think it's, maybe it is, as you were talking about before these jokes, you sort of didn't have a collective, like, oh, this is the person. Mm-hmm. And so though all your jokes are not about anxiety or depression, the rest of the jokes are like, oh, these are the jokes of a person with anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
Because I think you had older jokes that when you re-listen to, you're like...
No, I have a lot of opinions about food. For example, don't you think that any pizza can be a personal one if you cry while you eat it?
And that joke is like, oh, that's just funny, whatever. Right. But now you're like, oh, if you... That joke in this context...
Right. It's different. It's like a different experience. And I think there always has been a vein of like existentialism through most of my material, of like sort of questioning the why of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I talk a lot to comedians about persona and how often it feels like at first you're sort of trying to make the person on stage who you are off stage. Mm-hmm. It becomes a thing where the person you are in real life becomes more like the person you are on stage and becomes...
Right.
This weird middle ground. You aren't shy about being shy or introverted. What does that mean for you?
It's been interesting because I think I've gotten more introverted as I've gotten older. But I think it's interesting because I started as an introverted kid. And then I think a lot of times when you're kind of a more reserved kid, like everyone's like, oh, you got to come out of your shell. And then you think it's like something you have to get over. And, you know, to a degree, you do have to like put yourself out there to like make it in the world. But I think the older I've gotten, I'm like, oh, but it's also okay to not be the most outgoing person. Mm-hmm. So I think I've
doubled down on some aspects of my personality. Sure. And I think talking about it on stage feels good because I'm just like, this is something that I don't feel like I have to apologize or hide as much anymore. But it is interesting in, as a performer audience dynamic, because I do feel like after shows, people will sometimes be like, I just wanted to say I like your set, but I'll leave you alone because I know you're an introvert. And then I'm like, oh, well, now it's made it awkward for everyone. But
I guess you could be like, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for appreciating me in this time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, considering that doing comedy has been so linked to your mental health in so much as you feel like you started it partly because of like a certain surge of energy and has been doing this material and keep on doing this material sort of helped in however you define help?
I'm not sure. Like sometimes I think it's made it worse and then other times I think it's helped other people. And then, but then other times I'm like, I think it's helped me in my own writing in terms of like what I'm interested in talking about. I don't know if it's helped with the actual issues. I do feel like maybe those are more of an internal thing and like a thing where you have to kind of, you know, either go to therapy or get medication or like find, like I don't think that performing stand-up has necessarily like solved anything for me in that sense, like of my own mental illness.
And how much sort of do you get out of, you know, like I feel like talking to Maria Bamford, she very much was like, I'm going to destigmatize talking about mental illness on stage.
Yes.
Like, her very much was goal oriented of like, there's how much do you feel a responsibility or satisfaction from this is for the audience?
I think I agree with her idea of like, I also think she is goal-oriented in that way, but also talks about it in a way where it's just like, this is a part of who I am, and I'm not going to be like, oh, now I'm going to talk about mental illness, and it's going to be weird. Like, it's just another aspect of your experience. Like, and I think that is the good thing now about having, like, different, more people from diverse life experiences on stage, because then you realize that like everyone's normal is like so vastly different. But at the same time, like you're like, oh, but then I might very much relate to a straight white male talking about like the same neuroses or something. Yeah.
I was thinking about Bo Burnham has a line from his the last special that did where he talks about giving the audience something you can't give yourself. And I feel like I've heard a lot of comedians, especially young comedians, feel like, because they feel like their struggles are for the audience, it almost arrests their development in a lot of ways.
Hmm.
Do you feel like that it can let you off the hook in some ways? The sort of like, oh, my anxieties are now a thing that is for other people. You know, like, do you feel like there, as we were talking about how it might not have helped, do you feel like maybe it's even hurt?
Oh, right. Sometimes, I mean, I do think sometimes like I think about like not doing stand up and then I'm like, oh, but you're talking about these things that are helping people. So it seems like, or at least helping some people. So I think it's valuable to keep talking about them. But yeah, in that sense, it is kind of like, is stand up more for the performer or for the audience? And I think I sometimes get stuck in that paradox.
What would it mean to you if someone said you were their favorite comedian?
It's hard for me to not immediately be like, well, you're wrong. Like, you need to watch more comedy. But I think it's very, like, humbling because it is like, oh, man, you, like, listen to just, like, the way I see the world. And it, like, you know, you were open to it and that's and it resonated with you. And that's, like, very cool to hear.
This joke sort of has a sequel.
Yeah, I am someone who has a lot of anxiety, and it is weird that anxiety is finally on message. Like, if you're an anxious person, it's kind of like, well, you know, this is what we trained for. Like, this is our Olympics. It's like all those nights awake, like, it's showtime, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Because I did feel like after, like, right after the election, there was this, like, it almost felt like everyone was suddenly like depressed and anxious. And I was like, okay. Like I mean, I heard some other comedians who deal with it also talking about a version of this premise, but it was like, it was kind of like that thing where they all, like, a bunch of people moved into our neighborhood after the election, and it was like, it had become gentrified, like yeah. Mental illness had become gentrified. But yeah, it was just so odd, because, and it did feel like that joke really, like, struck a chord with people, especially right after the election. Still now, but yeah, I think everyone was, like, panicking.
Now that the audience is now coming to you more, like, now there's mm-hmm. now more, have you felt a shift? Has it made you, you know, how have you changed your comedy to adjust for that fact?
I have noticed that sometimes, like, if I start to talk about mental health, like, people will be more receptive because either they know it's something to expect from me, or, I think maybe they heard me on something where it was, like, they were like, oh, this is someone who might talk about these things. But, yeah, in the broader sense, I think it has made me a little bit more self-conscious about, like, making sure I'm, like, doing a great job, and, like, but I get, like, a little bit also worried about being like, well, you don't talk about these things just because people are like, oh, she's the person who talks about these things, like, make sure it's still, like, what you want to be talking about.
Yeah, make sure that it's still true to you.
Yeah.
And I think is interesting to you. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it could be like, yes, this, I still have these issues, but I am bored by them creatively.
Yeah, because it feels like I started talking about them as a way to kind of give them air. And it's like, if they've sucked all the air out of the room, that's the other extreme. Yeah.
Right after the election, you wrote a piece for the Village Voice urging comedians not to sort of settle for easy Trump jokes, to do something with their position, with their voice. And I think the nature of the type of comedian you are, especially on stage, I think Twitter has allowed you to do a more, a different type of comedy, mm-hmm. but on stage, especially as a person who I think works sort of inside out, you sort of start yes. with, how do you do that? How has it been?
For a while I was doing, like, more overtly political stuff, and now just, like, personally, I feel like I've become a little bit, like, burnt out on talking about politics, or it feels like maybe it's just, like, that thing of, like, well, you're preaching to the choir, yeah. like, your own bubble, so it's not even moving the needle on anything. But, yeah, so in that sense, I think I've been trying to use my platform more online, where I can maybe, like, spread information about, like, helping causes yeah. or something, but I'm like, I don't know if, like, jokes are necessarily doing anything for me concretely anymore or for the audience.
As a person who sees a lot of comedy, it is a thing of, you can feel an audience both be like, well, when's someone going to bring it up? And it feels like no one yeah. wants it. We're just like, yeah, yeah, but this is, it happened. And what are right. we going to not talk right. about? It is, yeah. I mean, it's just sort of a terrible paradox of, like, no one wants it, but if we don't bring it up, that's also bad.
Yeah. And it's, or even like the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where it felt like that turned into an outrage circus over, like, a set that wasn't that, you know, extreme or inflammatory. I think it also kind of feels like, well, if they're just going to use this now as, like, a distraction from, like, actually dealing with issues, then that makes me want to talk about it even less, because yeah. it's like, I don't want to give them more attention of any kind.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, well, now they have, like, figured out a way of turning whatever weapon there is of speaking truth yeah. to against.
Yeah. Or just, like, using it to stall more.
Yeah. And I think it's playing upon a certain amount of anxiety of, like, it's the same thing, like, you talked about with the improv community. Like, the suggestion is now yeah. this person said a joke, and you're like, well, yes. and then we're just spiraling.
Yes.
Spiraling.
Yes.
So you recently shared on social media that you had a cancel a tour because you have a new exciting project that you mm-hmm. can announce later. You said that you can't talk about what the project is, but it's very exciting. I have theories, but we're not going to get into it because I don't want to get you in trouble. Listening to your interviews over the year, you always sort of underplayed a certain desire of, like, I want a thing and it's going to be mine and I'm going to love it. Can you just sort of talk about not sort of what it is, but, like, what is exciting for you about it?
It's so funny. I've never, like, made a big announcement and withheld information before, and it's just been fascinating to me, like, people's reactions to it, because I'm like, your whatever people are projecting onto what it is yeah. is so much more exciting than it could ever be.
Sure.
But the thing that's exciting to me about it is, weirdly, that it does actually, one of the things that drew me to the project was that there is an opportunity to, like, talk about mental health and tell the stories of those kinds of experiences. So I think that was a big thing that drew me to it. And I think bringing those stories to light.
So I was listening to your mental illness happy hour episode, mm-hmm. and you said one of your fears is never being taken seriously as an artist. What does it mean to you to be? I mean, I literally just took you seriously as an artist for an hour, but also to get opportunities where they were like, it's not like we need a comedian, but like we want Aparna for these things.
That's kind of wild, because I did that interview a couple years ago. I don't even remember what year I did it, but I don't even know if I still have that fear, because after being in the industry more, I am like, a lot of stuff is outside your control, and really the only things you can control to a degree are stuff you create for yourself or like things you work on with friends. So, and even then it's like, you might not get the funding or it might fall through because of schedule. Like there's so much outside of your control that really, I think my new kind of ethos is just to do what makes you happy, because and happy in the broad sense of like what you find satisfying or worthwhile, because I think in that sense it will reflect like who you are as an artist versus like we were talking before where it's like, well, this is what people expect from you, so just keep doing more of that.
A similar question is, you used to start sets by going, I know, I'm surprised that I'm a comedian mm-hmm. too. Are you still surprised you're a comedian?
I don't think so. I think I would. I mean, I am, but I think I'm generally, in the more broader sense, surprised that I am a person at all.
So that sound means it's time for the laughing round. So it's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's laughing round.
Got it.
Faster questions, not about mental illness. This is a game called Explain an Obvious Joke. I'm going to give you two of your I'll give you two options of jokes of yours.
Okay.
Where you can say they're pretty short and then explain them as thoroughly as you want to. So two options. One is the two DJs fighting joke.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to explain, I just came back from Burning Man.
Oh, I can do the Burning Man one?
All right, so say the joke and then explain why it's funny.
So the joke is, I flew?
I just came back from Burning
Man. I just came back from Burning Man, and boy, are my arms spiders. And as the play on the joke, I just flew in from Blank City, and boy, mm-hmm. are my arms tired, but it's Burning Man, so everyone's on drugs, so your arms are spiders in your brain based on hallucinogens.
Oh, all right. That makes sense. When I say weekend at Bernie's, what is the scene that you remember?
Oh, man.
Weekend at Bernie's 2, which I...
Yeah, I was like, I think I've only seen the sequel. I think that I imagine them bringing, like, the two main guys bringing him
mm-hmm.
into, like, a job interview, maybe like where he works or like a restaurant, and he has his sunglasses on, and they like prop him up. That is all I remember from the movie.
If you could steal another comedian's joke where it's not like you're stealing it, but it's like the joke is yours forever, like it's sort of a alternate reality where that joke was in your brain first, and so you're not going to get in trouble, it's now just your joke. Is there a joke that you wish you could have? And what is the joke?
I think it would probably be like, and I don't even know if I have a specific one. There's one that Greg Johnson does about his dog, about people messing up dog genders, that really makes me laugh. I wonder, do I even know it off the top of my head? If people get so offended when you mess up a dog's gender where you're like, oh my gosh, is this your dog? He's so cute. And they're like, actually, it's a she, and her name is Jeremy. It's so silly, but it's so funny.
Do you have a favorite joke, like a street joke?
A street joke. I probably do. Oh, wait, I do have a street joke. Okay, it's so dumb. It's like from a kid's joke book, but I think, I don't know why it really got me early on, and I still think it's funny, but what did you call Batman and Robin when they were run over by a car?
What?
Flatman and Ribbon.
That's usually not how those jokes work.
Oh.
I know, I like
you
it.
You meant like a dirty...
I mean, like, usually I feel like a joke like that, it's a more surprising ending than just sort of like, now we have a pun based on the names.
I think I was just so impressed that they got both of them so good.
So now it's a game called Let's Write a Tweet.
Mm-hmm.
If you're willing, can you take out your phone and write a tweet? You do not have to publish it, but if you do, that'll be nice.
I can see if there are any drafts.
Sure. This is a game called What's in Your Twitter Drafts?
Oh, no. None of these are good.
That's fine. The game is the game. You have to read one. That's why they're in the drafts. If they're good,
okay,
they already...
Okay, here's one I wrote on an airplane that is still... I think I'm like, I'll figure it out, but I don't think I will. I just wrote, my favorite part of the airline safety video is breathe normally. Okay, sure. If you want, I'll post it, but I don't know if it makes sense.
I think it makes sense.
Really?
I laughed. Well, you can tweet, and if people don't like it, you can blame me.
I would never blame you.
This can be the last one. Do you have a joke that never worked, that you love and you kept on trying, but it just sort of never worked, but you will go to your grave thinking it's funny?
I have one, but I don't even think I can remember all of it. But I can try to explain it. It was a... I don't get the expression wrap my head around something. And then it was... And then the attempt at the joke was, what am I... Or like, what is my brain? A sarong? What is my brain? Second example, what is my brain? Third example, and the third example really made me laugh, but I don't think the entire joke made anyone laugh.
What was the third example?
I mean, to not remember it is really...
You're like, I know there's a third example.
Not making this a good story, but I don't remember the last example. But I mean, I really might be so inspired to bring it back. If I can locate it. What am I, a brainy sarong? What am I, It was just things that wrap around. Guys, you have to believe me.
The end.
The end.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can listen to Just Putting It Out There wherever you stream music. You can watch her episode of The Stand-Ups on Netflix and her episode of The Half Hour on the Comedy Central app. Follow Aparna on Twitter, at @aparnapkin. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Art Chung, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. The original episode was produced by Mike Comite with additional production help from Marika Brownlee. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us @goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me @JesseDavidFox. We'll be back next week with Patton Oswalt. Have a good one.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.